How did you happen to get in here?
I ran here. You scared the daylights out of me last night.
Seems like the truth shouldn't scare anybody, man or boy.
Thing getting you?
Oh, no. I'm just thinking about public reaction to all this.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to When It Was Cool Dark. This is episode number 345 of our podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. I am Carl Stern. This podcast is produced and distributed by whenitwascool.com. Can also be heard under the name Dragon King Dark at WrestlingObserver.com and figure4online.com, and across all your various podcasting platforms, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, everywhere you would expect a major podcast to be, there we are. Be sure to search up all of our free shows under the tag When It Was Cool in whatever podcast aggregator you use. This is part of an ongoing series called 100 of the Darkest Moments in Pop Culture History. This is actually the 73rd edition of this series, so we're getting very, very close to three-fourths of the way through. I know this hasn't been the happiest series. I know this has been quite a downer. We have many other shows that When It Was Cool that are quite fun and quite lighthearted, and we know this one's kind of a heavy show, but the name of the podcast is Dark, right? So one of the reasons I chose this particular series was I was trying to tie this podcast closer to what we do at whenitwascool.com, which is look at popular culture, particularly retro pop culture. And by that, I mean TV, movies, music, and also sports. And today's show topic is one of the darkest moments in sports history. And it's one that this year had its 50th anniversary. So it's maybe you saw something on this earlier in the year, maybe not. But it's certainly one of the most traumatic moments in sports history. It took place at the Olympics. And it was, I mean, in today's world, I think it would get even more coverage than what it did at the time. This is one of those strange ones that to me seems like it's sort of fallen under the radar, so to speak. But let's get it back out and examine it, because this was a very, very tragic incident. And I'm going to start by just, you know, telling you what it is and looking at it back from now to when it happened in history by way of the Washington Post, who covered the 50th anniversary of this tragic event back in September 5th, 2022. Diane Bernard wrote an article for the Washington Post titled 50 Years After Munich Olympics Attack, Victims' Families Are Compensated. And so this has been called many things. It's been called the Olympic Attacks, the Munich Massacre, the Olympic Tragedy. But by whatever name you know it under, it is one of the, I mean, it's frightening. I mean, you think about what happened here and how applicable it could still be to today's world, especially with all the things we've heard in the news, even the last couple of years, even the last several months. It gives one pause to think. The Washington Post article says 50 years ago, Monday, September 5th, 1972, Palestinian extremists infiltrated athletes' dorms at the Munich Summer Olympics, an attack that resulted in the murder of 11 Israeli athletes and coaches and a German police officer and set off an international crisis. It also led to 5 decades of complaints from the athletes' families that the German authorities had botched the response to the attack, concealed key details from them. Now, after years of legal wrangling, Germany has agreed to give 28 million euros to the families of the murdered Israeli athletes, the Israeli and German governments announced on Wednesday. quote, "We are pleased and relieved that an agreement on historical clarification, recognition, and compensation has been reached shortly before the 50th anniversary," German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier said in a joint statement with Israeli President Isaac Herzog. The agreement came just days before a 50th anniversary commemoration that the families had planned to boycott unless the German government offered what they deemed just compensation. Just a few weeks ago, the families had turned down an offer from Germany that would have amounted to about 200,000 euros for each family, according to Anke Spitzer, whose husband, Andre, an Olympic fencing coach, was murdered during the hostage standoff. Calling the initial offer an insult, Spitzer told German officials they could keep the money because it is not a dignified offer. Spitzer said in a phone interview from her home outside of Tel Aviv. She noted that compensation for international acts of terrorism usually range from about $3.5 million to $22 million per victim, according to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Families of passengers on Pan Am Flight 103 that blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988 each received $10 million, for example. The new agreement provides 1.2 million euros for each of the 23 eligible family members, Spitzer said. Billed as the, quote, Happy Olympics, the 1972 Munich Games were the first to be broadcast internationally on television. Looking to shed its Nazi past, West Germany aimed to project a harmonious image to the world, to erase memories of the 1936 Games in Berlin that were used as a platform for Hitler's propaganda. Swimmer Mark Spitz won a record-breaking 7 gold medals, a feat that remained unsurpassed until Michael Phelps won 8 in the 2008 Beijing Olympics. The USSR's Olga Korbut, dubbed the Sparrow from Minsk, became an international celebrity after stunning performances on the balance beam, floor exercises, and uneven bars. But in the early morning of September 5th, the image of unity was shattered when Palestinian militants with submachine guns stormed the apartment where 11 Israeli athletes were housed. The activists were members of the Black September group, which sought to bring attention to the Palestinian cause. Black September leaders thought the Olympics with an international TV audience would put their politics on the map. The 8 guerrillas immediately killed 2 athletes and 9 others were taken hostage, handcuffed, and beaten. The Palestinians demanded Israel, West Germany, and other nations release more than 200 political prisoners. If the demands weren't met by a certain time, the terrorists would kill 1 hostage per hour until all the prisoners were released. The Olympics of Serenity have become the one thing the Germans didn't want them to be, the Olympics of Terror. ABC TV announcer Jim McKay told his audience, according to the 1999 documentary, One Day in September. The image of a hooded Palestinian holding a machine gun on the balcony of the Olympic apartment became a worldwide symbol of lawlessness. West Germany contacted Israeli officials, experienced at negotiating with terrorists, but in the end turned down their offers to help. German officials had been warned of a potential action by Palestinian militants, but more concerned about maintaining a peaceful appearance, officials decided not to have armed police officers at venues, instead using unarmed security officers. For the next 20 hours, Germany tried to rescue the hostages, but were consistently foiled, including when cameras captured undercover police maneuvers, which the Palestinians saw on television in the Israeli team's apartment. Meanwhile, the United States hustled Jewish American Mark Spitz out of the Olympic Village for fear he'd be targeted. With talks stalled that night, the Palestinians requested an airplane to fly the remaining 9 hostages to an Arab nation to continue negotiations. German officials hatched a plan. They would send 5 snipers from a German Air Force base outside of Munich and put police officers on the plane to overtake the terrorist. Under West German law, the army couldn't get involved in what was called a civil matter, so Bavarian police with no counterterrorism experience had to lead the operation. Munich police officer Guido Schlossler was 21 and had just finished training when he was called to join 13 other officers to pre-board the Lufthansa plane to overtake the Black September leaders, he said in an email interview. The police officer in charge, quote, saw no chance of success in overpowering the terrorist in the confines of the plane and said it was a suicide mission. The officer proposed a vote to abort the mission, and the young, inexperienced lawman agreed to abandon the plan. When two helicopters holding the Palestinian terrorist and Israeli team members landed, chaos broke out. Two Palestinians boarded the plane, saw it had no crew or fuel, and realized it was a setup. As the German snipers opened fire, the Palestinians responded by firing back and hurling grenades at the helicopters, killing all the Israelis and one German police officer. Five Palestinians were killed in the shootout, three survived and were arrested. Families of the 11 murdered Israelis have decried how German authorities handled the episode. When searching for answers, family members said they were met with obstructions and sometimes hostility. After it first happened in 1972, one official told me, "You Jews brought the terror on yourselves and refused to release any documents," Spitzer said. Finally, in 1992, documents and photos were anonymously sent to Spitzer's lawyers, and then we saw the horror, she said. Photos showed the hostages brutally beaten, chained together, and covered in blood and feces. Before last week's agreement, families of the Israeli victims had received small humanitarian payouts from the German Red Cross and later the German government, which never formally accepted responsibility until now, Spitzer said. Racked with guilt, Guido Schlossler made a bold move last year. He reached out to Spitzer and her daughter to finally apologize for his role in the aborted rescue attempt. "I saw the dead Israeli athletes shot and tied up in their blood sitting in the helicopter," he said. "I saw the Palestinians shredded by their own hand grenades. All terrible images I couldn't get out of my head." When he said he was sorry for not being able to help save my husband, we all cried, Spitzer said. "Afterwards, I felt relieved as if a heavy burden had been lifted from my shoulders. I was able to make inner peace." So, as horrible as that sounds, it was absolutely that horrible. Can you imagine today here in 2022 such a thing happening? I mean, it's within the realm of possibility, right? Anti-Semitism is still running rampant in today's world, as we've seen just recently in the news here in the United States. This was an absolutely botched situation. It was an absolutely preventable situation, almost certainly. And this is a really stern example of what happens, and this still happens a lot of times in law enforcement and even here in the United States, where you have these politicians that just want to put on a happy smile. They want to disregard anything negative that may be going on, whether it's a drug epidemic or whether it's some sort of systemic violence or systemic oppression or something like that. They want to just smile and say, none of this happens here. That happens other places. Everything's just fine here as the world burns around them. This one literally blew up in their face, and it's good that at least as much as could be acquired, the families of these victims have managed to get some tiny degree of compensation for this, although nothing whatsoever could cover the brutality and horror of this incident. Often called the Munich Massacre, this was the attack during the 1972 Summer Olympic Games in Munich, West Germany. Shortly after the hostages were taken, the group Black September demanded the release of actually 234 Palestinian prisoners who were being held in Israeli jails, plus the West German imprisoned founders of the Red Army faction, Andreas Baader and Ulrich Meinhof. West German police ambushed the terrorists and killed five of the eight Black September members, but the rescue attempt failed and all the hostages were killed. A West German policeman was also killed in the crossfire, and the West German government was criticized for the poor execution of its rescue attempt and its overall handling of the incident. The three surviving perpetrators were Adnan Al-Gashi, Jamal Al-Gashi, and Mohammed Safradi, who were all arrested, only to be released the next month in the hostage exchange which followed the hijacking of the Lufthansa Flight 615. By then, the Israeli government had launched Operation Wrath of God, which authorized Mossad to track down and kill anyone who had played a role in the attack. So you can see this has far-reaching international implications. 2 days prior to the start of the 2016 Summer Olympics, in a ceremony led by Brazilian and Israeli officials, the International Olympic Committee honored the 11 Israelis and one German who were killed at Munich. In the 2020 Summer Olympics, a moment of silence was observed in the opening ceremony. So, what actually led up to this massacre, this horrendous event? When we come back after our mid-show break, let's take a look at the prelude, which laid the groundwork for this one of the most tragic and horrific incidents in Olympic history, for sure, and one of the 100 darkest moments in pop culture history, which also includes, in our view, sports as well, a dark, dark time, the first internationally telecast Olympics with one of the darkest clouds ever hanging over it. We'll be back right after this.
This is an ITN newsflash from the Olympic Village in Munich, where early this morning, armed Palestinian guerrillas raided the sleeping quarters of the Israeli team. The gunmen shot dead two Israelis and are now holding 20 athletes and six officials as hostages. The guerrillas are demanding the release of 250 Arabs held prisoner in Israel and have set noon as the deadline for their release. Negotiations are going on with the German government. The raid happened at about 4 a.m. A liaison officer with the Israeli team takes up the story.
The police told us that between 4 and 5 o'clock this morning, a group of Arab Palestinian terrorists rushed inside the building, killed the coach of our wrestlers, Moshe Weinberg, and took as hostages some of our sportsmen. Afterwards, they gave an ultimatum that until 12 o'clock today, some of the Arabic terrorists who are held in prison in Israel must be released, otherwise they are going to kill some of the sportsmen who are staying there in their hands.
The Arab Palestinians are in control of the Israeli bloc?
I don't know if the whole block, but at least at one of the entrances, which have some of the Israeli sportsmen there.
How was the Israeli killed?
I don't know, but as I can assume, he was killed in his bed.
After the shooting, the Palestinians allowed an ambulance to drive in to pick up one of the wounded Israelis, but the ambulance men retreated without him when firing suddenly started between the Palestinians and the police. The Israeli died soon afterwards. His colleague died in the flats. Nearly 500 German security police have now sealed off the village and are mounting heavy machine guns in the square. They are keeping cameramen and television reporters and spectators well away. The guerrillas have just announced that they are demanding to be allowed to fly out of Germany to an unknown destination once their demands have been met. Meanwhile, with an hour to go to the deadline at noon, the Olympic Games...
We depend on Patreon support for our website and podcast network. In order to continue these podcasts you enjoy, we need you to visit whenitwascool.com and pledge at least $1. You'll gain access to lots of exclusive podcasts, newsletters, and more. Sign up is quick, simple, and can be canceled at any time. whenitwascool.com and click any Patreon link. Thank you.
As you can imagine, there was some groundwork that led up to this. There was some plotting and planning, and there's even an accusation that the German government, had foreknowledge of this attack. What if any of this is true? The hostages were taken during the second week of the 1972 Summer Olympics. The West German Olympic Organizing Committee had hoped to discard the military image of Germany. The committee was wary of the image portrayed by the 1936 Olympics, which Nazi dictator Adolf Hitler used for his propaganda. Security personnel known as the Ollies were inconspicuous, but were prepared to deal mostly with ticket fraud and drunkenness. Certainly nothing of this sort of terrorist magnitude. The documentary film, One Day in September, claims that security in the athletes' village was unfit for the games and that athletes could come and go as they pleased. Athletes could sneak past security and go into other countries' rooms by going over the fencing that encompassed the village. The absence of armed personnel had worried the Israeli delegation and even the coaches even before the team itself arrived in Munich. It turns out this was well-founded. In later interviews with journalists, the coach said that he had expressed concern with the relevant authorities about his team's lodging. The team was housed in a relatively isolated part of the Olympic Village, on the ground of a small building close to a gate. The coaches felt this made his team particularly vulnerable to an outside assault. The West German authorities apparently assured the coaches that extra security would be provided to look after the Israeli team, but the coaches doubted that any measures were ever taken. And as we now know, if there were any measures taken, they were extraordinarily insufficient. Olympic organizers asked West German forensic psychologist Georg Sieber to create 26 terrorism scenarios to aid the organizers in planning security. His Situation 21 accurately forecast armed Palestinians invading the Israeli delegation's quarters. Wow. Killing and taking hostages and demanding Israel's release of prisoners and a plane to leave West Germany. Organizers balked against preparing for Situation 21 and the other scenarios, since guarding the games against them would have gone against their goal of this smiley, very naive, carefree games, as they were being called. They did not want the heavy security there. Did they have foreknowledge of this attack? Well, I guess they failed to go along with this Situation 21, but was there more even than that? The German weekly news magazine Der Spiegel wrote in 2012 that West German authorities had a tip-off from a Palestinian informant in Beirut about 3 weeks before the massacre. The informant told West Germany that Palestinians were planning an incident at the Olympic Games, and the foreign ministry in Bonn viewed the tip-off seriously enough to pass it to the Secret Service in Munich and urged that all possible security measures be taken. But according to the paper Der Spiegel, the authorities failed to act on the tip and had never acknowledged it in the following 40 years. The magazine said that this was only part of a 40-year cover-up by the German authorities of the mishandling of its response to the massacre. So once again, as they're caught utterly unprepared, utterly unable, untrained to deal with this incident, and after the fact, they have tried for over 40 years to cover it up, and only now, 50 years after the fact, have paid any sort of compensation to the families. In the wake of the hostage-taking, competition was suspended for 34 hours. For the first time in modern Olympic history, after public criticism of the Olympic Committee's decision to continue the games, yes, the show went on. On September 6th, a memorial service attended by 80,000 spectators and 3,000 athletes was held in the Olympic Stadium. IOC President Avery Brundage made little reference to the murdered athletes during a speech, praising instead the strength of the Olympic movement and equating the attack on Israeli sportsmen with the recent arguments about encroaching professionalism and disallowing Rhodesia's participation in the games, which outraged many listeners. Yes, they basically utterly ignored the fact they were having a memorial ceremony for all these murdered Israeli athletes and instead, you know, spoke on their other political pet peeves. I mean, you know, not to say anti-Semitic, but how else can you possibly read this, right? The victims' families were represented by Andre Spitzer's widow, Anki. as well as family members of the other murdered athletes. During the memorial service, one collapsed and died of a heart attack. Wow. Many of the 80,000 people who filled the Olympic Stadium for West Germany's football match with Hungary carried noisemakers and waved flags. But when several spectators unfurled a banner reading, 17 dead, already forgotten, security officials removed the sign and expelled those responsible from the grounds. During the memorial service, the Olympic flag was flown at half staff, along with the flags of most of the other competing nations, at the request of Willy Brandt. 10 Arab nations, however, objected to their flags flying at half staff, and the mandate was rescinded. I mean, politics just spitting in the face of these murdered athletes in this, you know, unquestionably terrorist incident. Just absolutely unacceptable. I mean, that they had to go through all this and still 50 years later trying to fight for some degree of compensation. It just goes to show you the hard-headedness of many in the world and how politics oftentimes makes ignorant fools of people. 4 years later, the 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal, the Israeli team commemorated the massacre when they entered the stadium at the opening ceremony. Their national flag was adorned with a black ribbon. I guess they let them get by with that particular tribute. Now, remember, all the Black September members weren't killed. And from what we've been led to believe so far, didn't receive justice either, right? Two of the three surviving gunmen, Mohammed Safadi and Adnan El-Gashi, were allegedly killed by Mossad as part of Operation Wrath of God. Al-Gashi was allegedly located after making contact with a cousin in a Gulf state, and Safadi was found by remaining in touch with family in Lebanon. This account was challenged in a book, however, by Aaron J. Klein, who claims that Al-Gashi died of heart failure in the 1970s and that Safadi was killed by Christian phalangist in Lebanon in the early 1980s. This was a Christian political party out of Lebanon, by the way. However, in July of 2005, the PLO veteran Tafak Terry told Klein that Safadi, whom Terawi claimed as a close friend, was, quote, as alive as you are. So even as late as 2005, members of those circles were claiming he was still alive as well. So were all three of them still alive? The third surviving gunman, Jamal Al-Gashi, was known to be alive as of 1999 and hiding in North Africa or Syria, claiming to still fear retribution from Israel. He is the only one of the surviving terrorists to consent to interview since 1972, having granted an interview in 1992 to a Palestinian newspaper, and having briefly emerged from hiding in 1999 to participate in an interview for the film One Day in September, during which he was disguised and his face only shown in a blurry shadow. Now, we've referenced several times this One Day in September, and so I think it's important we mention what that is in case you want to seek it out for yourself. It's a 1999 documentary about the murder of the 11 Israeli athletes, and it won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Film Feature at the 72nd Academy Awards. And so if you want to seek that out, apparently it is one of the primary and best sources for the entire story on this. NPR, in acknowledgement of the 50th anniversary of this, in an article published September 4th, 2022, said 50 years ago, the Munich Olympics massacre changed how we think about terrorism. It was just after 4 a.m. when an attack that would shock the world began, quietly. Eight men in tracksuits hopped the fence at Munich's Olympic Village, carrying with them rifles and grenades in a duffel bag. They were members of the group Black September, an affiliate of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Their mission was to hold Israeli athletes hostage and demand the release of 236 prisoners, 234 in Israel, and two leaders of the West German of a West German terrorist group. Their mission failed. About 20 hours after it began, five of the hostage takers would be dead, along with 11 members of Israel's Olympic team and a West German policeman. But the Munich massacre of September 5th to September 6th, 1972, would have lasting repercussions on an international scale, waking up the Western governments to the threat of terrorism, showing the power of live broadcast, and setting the stage for future violence. Munich 1972 was supposed to be the opposite of the Berlin Games, as we talked about several times. They wanted this to be the cheerful games, all about friendship, shedding their military image. But as we now know, that went terribly wrong. David Clay Large, a senior fellow at the Institute of European Studies at the University of California, said they wanted to come across as playful, a laid-back, congenial set of games, not a police state. Authorities were aware of security threats, but they were coming from different directions. There was the Red Army faction, Andreas Baader, and Ulrich Meinhof's leftist group, which had carried out bombings in West Germany that year. The far-right National Democratic Party of Germany was a concern, as were other groups. Despite warnings, the idea of a Palestinian group carrying out an attack was not at the top of their list for possible dangers. The games had already gone on for 10 days without a serious incident, and security officials had let down their guard. Well, as we know now, there wasn't much of a guard put up to begin with. The gunman, having already scouted the location, easily slipped into the building that housed the Israelis. They knew which apartment to go to. Black September ended up with 9 hostages after killing wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg and weightlifter Yosef Romano, who had both fought back against the attackers. The group demanded the release of the 236 prisoners, most of them, of course, held in Israel, as we mentioned. And as West German authorities scrambled to figure out how to respond that morning, the games resumed as normal. It was at least 7 hours into the hostage situation by the time events were halted. And as we know, the rescue attempt was a complete and absolute utter failure. This NPR article concludes with this: perhaps the security budgets have kept the events of Munich from being repeated, though terrorism would strike the Olympics again in Atlanta in 1996 when a bomb exploded, killing one person directly and another person indirectly and injuring more than 100. It was half a century ago that Munich presaged for the world the era of international terrorism, only to fully crystallize to Americans on September 11th. It was basically sending the message, because the theme of the Olympics is peace and cooperation. If the Olympics weren't safe, nothing would be, says Hoffman, the terrorism researcher. It ushered in, I think, the modern era of terrorism that we're still enmeshed in today and can't escape. So the 1972 Munich Olympic massacre of the Israeli athletes certainly deserves a spot in one of the 100 darkest moments in pop culture history, in sports history, certainly of Olympic history, and bears an examination of what was done, what wasn't done, the politics and the outright terrorism that led to this incident. It's certainly one of the most damning moments in sports history. Well, this show has been brought to you by whenitwascool.com. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope you'll support our website and whenitwascool.com by going to our website and bookmarking the page, subscribing to all of our free shows. We have multiple free feeds. But ultimately, as a way of helping us, a way of keeping these shows coming, the way of keeping us online, is to become a Patreon supporter. And we have a large Patreon community. They are very active, very kind community. And we have over 2,000 podcasts in our archives right now that you can be downloading. These are retro pop culture shows, movies, TV, sports reviews, They're evergreen, so they're just as relevant now as they ever were. So you can, you've been looking for something new to listen to, tired of your same old podcast? Well, we have a ready-to-go archive. Become a Patreon supporter and start downloading. You're going to find almost certainly many shows you'll very much enjoy on popular culture history, and many of the things you grew up loving, we've probably talked about. If not, as a Patreon supporter, you're able to request shows. So thank you very much for listening and checking us out at whenitwascool.com, and I'll see you back here again soon with another show. Hey, everybody. Carl here from whenitwascool.com. I've talked to you a lot about our Patreon, which is the most important way you can support us. But let me remind you of what else we do. You can follow us on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Grab the links off the front page of whenitwascool.com. Check out all of our free podcasts on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, and other major podcast outlets. Check out Dragon King Dark, along with Stuck in the Desert podcast, Uphill Both Ways, Wrestling with the Dog, The Thrash Metal Show, Life and Times with KZ, our new show, The Plot, Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling Audio Show, Fireside Chat and Heel Mustache Podcast, plus many specials every month. Go to whenitwascool.com for everything retro pop culture and more. Hit that Patreon link for premium podcast content. If you're looking for something fresh and fun to listen to, then bookmark whenitwascool.com.